And welcome back to the show, everyone. My name is Brian Elam. I will be your host here on the Be Successful series. And today we have a special guest with us. Anan Narayan is here. And he's shaking his head, so I got the pronunciation right. That's amazing.
Got it right.
All right. So Anan has had a very varied career in his life, starting out with what I assume to be the military aspect, going into the Navy and then getting into entrepreneurship and then finally into the mergers and acquisitions type of world. So this is going to be a good conversation, a high level conversation, especially if you're in the mid journey of your entrepreneurial trip or even on the higher end. This is going to be a great conversation. So Anan, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Brian. Really appreciate everything that you're doing and excited to be here. Excited for the conversation.
Absolutely. Well, let's get into it. I typically like to start at the beginning of people's journeys. So my question is, have you been interested in business your whole life, or is this something that took hold later on in life and just kind of ran with it from there?
Yeah, I would definitely say it's been my whole life that I've been interested in business. So my father started his first company in 1999. So I was about 9 years old then. Didn't really know what's going on. Of course, wasn't really a part of it. But as you go into middle school and then high school, you start, you know, you're part of the home household conversations. You start learning about finance. You start learning about when there's cash flow problems and recessions and those kind of things hitting the general business aspects. So my interest, you know, started from there. My mom was also an investment banker. So always kind of hearing about the finance jargon and I used to see black cars outside of our house, taking her on trips and it was awesome. So always been interested in business. I know I didn't start my career, I would say, in business. You know, my parents were Indian. They, of course, wanted me to be a doctor or an engineer. So went the engineering route. And then went into the Navy post that when I was deciding what to do. But of course, eventually ended up in the business world after that experience. So pretty exciting journey.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Because I remember reading that you had gone into nuclear and chemical engineering and then had gone, you know, went to the Navy. But I was assuming, like a lot of people, they go into the military and they pick their career path. I thought that might have been where you got into the chemical and nuclear engineering, was because you were working in that aspect with the Navy. But it was kind of, it was the reverse, huh?
Yes. It was definitely, I was thinking of what to do in college. I actually wanted to be an aerospace or aeronautical engineer. But at that time, you know, we didn't have SpaceX and Blue Origin and all these things going crazy. So I went to something more broad like chemical engineering, and then went from chemical engineering, trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And then I came across the NUPOC program, which is the Nuclear Propulsion Officer Candidate Program for the U.S. Navy. Because all of our aircraft carriers, as an example, are on nuclear power. So you need nuclear operators to do that. And same with all the submarines. So that's how I went into that path, went into the Navy as a NUPOC. And so as a surface warfare officer and a nuclear propulsion officer in the Navy, finished my contract 5 years, and then I came up. So that's how I got into the engineering space. Was undergrad was engineering, went into kind of an engineering job and decided, nope, you know, I want to go into the business world.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you first and foremost for your service to the country.
Thank
we
you.
All greatly appreciate you doing that. The next question is, after you got out and decided you want to move into business, now was the first venture that you went into, was it that IT staffing company or was it something else?
It was the IT staffing company. So IT Trailblazers was actually the dad that the company my dad founded in 1999. So when I joined him, we were doing about 12 million in revenue, give or take, you know, so it was a pretty well established small business, at the time. And, I started at the bottom. I started as a recruiter, moved my way up in the company, you know, within 2 years, you know, I was pretty much taking over the recruitment division, and became the COO of the company. So that was the first venture I would say that I went into, after the Navy and my, I guess, private experience.
So essentially getting into the family business and coming up in the ranks and seeing how everything worked basically from the ground up, right?
Exactly. I mean, you name it, I've done it in that company, right? From HR, finance, payroll, accounts receivable and payable, you know, from all the backend operations to actually being a recruiter, using the tools and services to do the entire business, you could say, before moving into management, which I think was a big advantage on learning how everybody does their job in the company, what can be automated, and how do you bring in technology into that company to make it grow at a faster pace. So I think I had that advantage because I started from the bottom versus, you know, just jumping in at the top right under my dad as an example.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was a smart decision, obviously, on yours and probably his part as well, to give you that background and platform to work from. And when you were coming up in those ranks and seeing everything and finally made it up into the management, is that when you kind of took things over and then got it to the point where it was ready to sell, or is that business still around, or how did that first story kind of end for you?
Yeah, I think that the biggest advantage, like you said, was starting from the bottom. So I understood what each person and each level, from a recruiter to a team lead to a recruitment manager, would do in the organization. I also spent 6 months, a year for a couple of years in India, setting up our offshore operations. So we almost had a 24-hour cycle there where we had, you know, US recruitment happening in night shift, we had India recruitment happening in day shift, and then we had this mid shift that was doing development work. I mean, it was literally 24-hour operations. So learn the ranks through that. And then it's exactly what you said, you know, that's when I became a manager, figure out how to put a lot of automation into the business, and then figured out, you know, where should we double down on our investments? I think entrepreneurship is great. I think a lot of people do a fantastic job as the entrepreneur and founder, but sometimes you don't look at, hey, what does the data show you, right? Because you haven't been using data to make all of the decisions, as an example. And sometimes when you look at the data and you put in a mechanism to collect it, you know where to double down. So what we were able to do is in that 4 years, we went from 12 million to actually 65 million in revenue, doubling down on where the data said double down. So if there was a certain tool yielding more results, okay, double down on that tool as an example. If there's a team or a recruitment leader doing better, move more recruiters there. We used to make those decisions. And that really helped scale the business. So customer service went up, you know, ability to service requirements and contracts went up, and then the revenue exploded through that. And then we were able to insert automation and robotic process automation, not AI at the time, into this to make everything smoother and faster. So we were able to do this at scale without increasing too much headcount. And then at the end of those 4 years, we did sell. So in 2020, we sold the company when we were doing about 65, or there's a little bit down market there, like 60 million-ish in revenue. And that's when we sold the company in 2020. So we are no longer associated with the company.
Okay. And when you're talking about both human capital and then the automation side of it, what would you say is the split as far as importance? Would it be 50-50, 60-40? Like, what would you say that importance is to focus on for a business to get to that point where they're ready to sell?
Good question. Well, I think there's a few aspects before you go to sell that you need to do. I will definitely say during the first sale experience here, we did not go through everything. I think we had a tremendous amount of learning, and most small businesses only sell once. So it's kind of a tough position to be in because you really know how to run your business, but you don't really know how to sell a business, which is like a whole other business in itself. So actually, I think the most important part of all of it before you go into, say, process automation and figuring out that is more of the financial engineering aspect, right? You have so much value in your business, but you don't know how to showcase it. And just a simple example. If you have a business doing reoccurring revenue and you have Fortune 1000 clients, I mean, putting that as a line item as, hey, I'm doing business that's reoccurring with Fortune 1000 clients is a big value add. Most companies, we put it all in one bucket. Hey, sales. And then you have no idea where that sales is coming from. It could be your smallest company in the world that's giving you sales. It could be your largest. But the larger companies give you a lot more value. So the financial engineering aspect, I think, takes a big chunk of the priority. And then you move into automation. And I think both add a lot of value because a key metric I think you should look into companies is revenue per headcount, right? So if you're able to optimize or maximize the utilization of your people, right, that sometimes keeps your headcount lower. And if you're not doing tasks well, you can outsource those tasks. So as an example, if you don't need a full CFO that you're paying, you can have a fractional CFO, and you can play with that to make sure that your revenue per headcount is high. And that's when automation then comes into play, is can you see the repeated tasks and automate them? But till you have, I think, everything in a structure, you shouldn't just go to automation, because then you don't know what you're automating. And you don't have the data to do the automation to see if that automation yielded you anything from that perspective.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. It's like putting the cart before the horse. You know, when it comes to automation, exactly. You do that, you don't know where you're going, and neither does the horse.
Exactly. And Elon Musk in his new book gave a fantastic example of where he said, just go automate the plan. And these guys went and automated, his team, who are all mind-blowing engineers, right? When automated the plan without understanding like each piece of the puzzle. And that's when he went and slept in the factory, and he's like, okay, what does this automation process do? What does this machine do? Can a human do it absolutely faster? Is the quality higher if a human does it versus the automated machine? And then they went and gutted all the machines and put humans back in the process, because they didn't truly understand each step in their process. And they went to automate first. And he goes through why you should understand the process first and the system that you want to do, and then why you're automating it and what is the ROI before you go and automate it. And can automation really help you versus is it going to be detrimental in something else? So pretty cool concept that came out of his book.
Absolutely. Now I want to go back just a little bit. You have this concept, financial engineering, and mm-hmm. I have never heard this term before. So okay. You went into a little bit of it with, describing how to position things in under one big umbrella of sales, but position them as something that is a value add. And that would be a component, I'm gathering, of financial engineering. But is that all it is? Is basically breaking out each sector and define where the value nuggets are so you can present them? Or is there actual number crunching and things involved in this too?
Yeah, it's a little bit more complex than that. That was just one aspect of how do you show that, hey, my revenue is highly valuable. And it might not work for all companies if all of the companies you're working with are, for example, a small business, or you're a direct-to-consumer business versus a direct-to-company business, right? B2B. But there's a lot more that comes into it. Let's take another example of payment terms. Everybody looks, when you're going to sell your company and there's somebody looking to buy, they're looking at cash flows. Hey, how much money are you borrowing from the bank? What is kind of your working capital that's required? And they will make you keep the working capital as part of the business. And there's ways to also look at that. If, you know, a traditional business where maybe the founder is a great entrepreneur, but not great at finances, right? They might not be collecting their invoices on time, which is increasing maybe the loan amount that they need to borrow. Then they're like, oh crap, the loan is getting too high. Let me go invoice all my clients. Let me get all the money and pay the loan balance off. So having systems in place that trigger automatically, right? Hey, it's the end of the month. You know, today is, say, March 3rd. I need to invoice all of my clients for February. That should hit immediately. It should be done in the first 48 hours of the next month. You shouldn't wait, because then you have a 30-day or 60-day or 90-day payment terms on that, right? So the money's going to come in 90 days later. So if you send the invoice on March 15th or March 30th or April 1st, you know, you're pushing your payment terms out. And that increases the working capital requirement. So you really need to have it automated where emotion comes out of it, where it just triggers. It's like, okay, it's the first of the month, boom, invoice all these clients, we know exactly where it is. So you put systems and processes in place to decrease that working capital requirement, because money is coming in earlier. And then same thing that you're doing with your vendors, right? So now instead of the vendor sends an invoice, you're like, man, I got to pay this invoice and just pay it. You're like, no, you know, you have 30-day payment days. Let's make that 60. Let's go negotiate with them and make it 60. Let's push those out. And that should be a trigger too. Okay, bill comes in today. You should schedule it, right? Your assistant or whoever it is puts it in, you're going to go and approve it. But it should only pay them in that 60-day timeframe. It shouldn't go today or tomorrow, because it's on your head. So you need to put those systems in place. And then if you have cash available, you should have that in something that's yielding high interest, which nobody thinks about, right? Especially in today's market where, you know, you put it into a money market fund that's yielding 5% instead of sitting in your bank account that's yielding 0.001%, right? So yeah, keep your reserves or your month, whatever you need to keep in that account, so you're not, you know, causing any fines or whatever for yourself, but take the rest of the money and put it in a money market fund and then let it yield 5%. So you're making money on that money as well. So it's not sitting there. So you should have these processes in place, which are all safe investments. I'm not saying go throw your money in real estate and get stuck, or put it in a 12-month CD and you need that money tomorrow. I'm not saying do that, but right. Yield 5% for free, you know, instead of paying the bank the 5%. They're doing the same thing with your money. So putting those things in place makes a company, I think, highly valuable, where you're really, the founder might not have to be there to make all the decisions. You know, the team knows the triggers are happening, it's getting automated to some extent with someone overseeing. And that's another aspect of financial engineering that's very helpful. And the big thing that a lot of founders do, including mistakes we've made, is, you know, you do have personal expenses. A lot of owners put personal expenses on their companies, which is fine. It's become kind of a traditional practice. You might have your car or whatever on your company, which is fine. But when you're going to sell, you better start thinking about that 6 months or 1 year in advance. And a lot of founders, when they're burnt out or they're ready to retire, it's like a flip. They're like, all right, let's go sell the business. And you have all of this personal expenses in the company. And then when you go to negotiate saying, no, it's an add back, it's not a company expense. If I'm a buyer, why would I believe that your trip to wherever was a personal expense, right? You might say, hey, I have family in California and I'm flying to California to meet them. Cool. But that could have been a business meeting and I don't know. So I'm not going to validate that as your personal expense, right? As an example. So why even go into those nitty gritty negotiations? 6 months before, you should just clean it up, right? Remove the car. Nobody wants it. Remove the insurances. Remove all of the payments. Remove your phone bill or your utilities, or if you have a home office, whatever you're doing there, you got to clean up the books so you don't have those add back conversations and all that. And I know the big question that comes from founders is, hey, what about taxes? Now we're going to, you know, as founders, we want to lower our tax burden, but that brings your EBITDA down when you go to sell. Well, yes, but your EBITDA multiple is much higher when you sell. So you might have to pay taxes higher for 1 year, but you're going to get 3x or 4x, whatever that multiple that you saved, and you don't have to have a conversation with the buyer. So it's better to pay the higher tax and get the higher multiple and sell in a cleaner way than worrying about, hey, how do I, you know, penny pinch on taxes as an example, right? So there's multiple aspects, I would say, to the financial engineering process that really makes a company valuable and shows that it's professional. And a good analogy is when you're trying to sell your house and someone's walking in to see your house, you make it as it's like nobody lived there, right? It is beautiful. I mean, you have everything set. Maybe they walk in, your Alexa starts playing music. So you create some whatever ambiance of what you want to create. So someone walks in and sees your books and it's a mess. That's like having your sheets all over the place and having your pillow thrown to the side and having a hole in your wall. They're going to look at this company and be like, probably not as valuable. Looks like a fixer-upper. And that's kind of the analogy that I use there. You want it to be clean. There should not be a single hole that they can poke in your books. And we got to get it to that level.
Wow. There's
sorry, maybe a long way of answering.
No, it was great. Again, I told you guys at the beginning, this is going to be a more high-level conversation. So this is great. I am glad that you went into all those details and examples because it can help solidify in someone's mind why these things are so important and why you do need to clean up the books, why you do need to get rid of those misconceptions. Absolutely. And then just going a little bit farther down that road, getting away from the actual fix, what does your company look for when it comes to potentially acquiring and working with a company? Like, what are you looking for?
Yeah, so I categorize my company, Kenobi Capital, as a private equity company because it needs to fit a category that people understand. So private equity is a good way to put it in a bucket that people can understand what the company does. But really what we're trying to do is, so with my first sale of the company, we got bought by a private equity company and they put in four more companies. They made it $100 million in revenue. And I believe they just sold it this year or in 2023. Sorry, they sold it in 2023 and they've exited. And that's what a lot of private companies traditionally do, right? They're going to buy small businesses at the lowest valuation they're able to get. They're going to put the companies together, make it one company, clean out, you know, all the fat, you could say, trim the fat and sell it again to somebody that might want to hold the company for long term or whatever their next investment criteria looks like. Now, in this process, the founder and the small business owner doesn't get that upside because they're getting bought out because their company is not set up to sell the capital markets. It's not cleaned up their books. They haven't done these things. So they are going to sell at maybe a 3 or a 4X multiple, depending on the company type. And then they're going to have a lot of things like, hey, you need to sign a 2-year employment contract. You need to hit certain earnouts, and I'm going to put 30% in earnout. So if you don't hit your earnouts and you're down market, well, you're not getting that money. And they end up on average, the statistic is that most companies sell at a 2.5x EBITDA, which is really low. So what we are doing is we've created an exit accelerator. So actually, we are finding companies that want to sell where the owners haven't fixed all of these problems. So we are okay with that. But you just need to have kind of a positive cash flow. And we want them to come into this exit accelerator where we clean up all these things. So we go through financial engineering. Then we go through, you know, operational optimization. Like what are the systems and processes in place? Can we maximize them resources, right? So do you have people and they're only doing 20% of their time, right? Instead, you know, can you outsource that as an example and increase your profitability? Then we look at, can we put an automation into that business? So we clean up all of these things. And then we say, hey, you can leave us if you want and exit some other way. Or we give you two exit options. One is you join a roll-up structure where we call it a virtual roll-up, where you are still running your own company, but we put all the companies together, we market and we sell the whole group to capital markets. So now instead of a 3x EBITDA that you might get on your own, as an example, you can sell at an 8x or 10x because valuations go up with scale. There's more demand for a $50 million company than there is for a $3 million company. So when you put 10 $3 million companies or $5 million companies together, you can get a huge multiple difference. So we give them that value as well. My true goal is to partner with founders and maximize their value and get them a, you know, kind of a peaceful exit where they're confident that they're doing the right thing. They have their trust in the right person and somebody is not taking advantage of them. And they will safely move into, say, retirement if that is their goal, right? Versus, okay, what if this person does something wrong? What if this ends up in a lawsuit? Am I going to get my money? You know, there's earnouts, there's employment contracts. The goal is, hey, can I get rid of all of that? Can I set up the company well, put it in this kind of roll-up structure, right? And then exit to a capital market professional company and get that upside versus the private equity company, a traditional private equity company taking all that upside. And the reason I do it is because I believe small business owners and the ones taking the risk are the backbone. Right, 80% of people are employed at small businesses, as an example, right? So they are the backbone of the economy, but they don't get the upside because they don't know how to play the finance game, which that's life. But maybe I feel it's a little unfair and I want the small business owner to get that value. And that's what I'm looking to create, is to make sure they get that upside to the final sell of capital markets without companies coming in, squeezing, you know, both sides and selling it, as an example.
Well, that is a perfect walkthrough and great example. And I love the fact that you're doing this because, number one, you believe that small business is the backbone of the US, which I absolutely agree with. And number two, you feel that essentially you're lining up with my mantra for my company, which is good people deserve lots of money, you know? And if you can grow your business and set it up to that point where you can get that 3, 5, 8, 10x multiple, then why not do that to go put into your next venture, you know, support your family legacy, grow that generational wealth, whatever it is you want to do. Why not give yourself and your business that opportunity? And that kind of goes into what I wanted to touch on next is, let's say, looking at both sides of this argument, so to speak, you've got a CEO and he doesn't know whether or not he actually wants to sell yet. What he does know is things are not running as optimal as they could, not as cleanly as they could be. Is there some kind of a checklist that you would go down? Like, here's the categories that you need to hit and understand where you're at in order to be able to lift yourself up to that point to either maximize your company or get ready to sell.
Yeah, absolutely. So internally, we're actually creating that checklist right now. We've been doing it for a while, but we haven't created a proper checklist. So we are actually creating that. We want to make it a free resource for other CEOs to use. But honestly, what I think is, so IT Trailblazers was one company. I was a COO there, and I took over finances as well. So I was taking over the finance department, the HR department, and all the operational delivery functions. Except I wasn't really responsible for sales at that time, but always in client conversations. Then we had ITT Digital, which we grew over 3 years. We're actually exiting that right now, and that's why I'm starting this new venture. is we're exiting that as well. So I've had two exits and gone through this. And what I think now as CEO of that company, you know, you are good at what you are good at. So if you tell a CEO that is very sales oriented, like my dad, he's amazing sales guy. He will build any relationship you want. He'll go play golf with them, wine, and he'll do all of it, right? He's an amazing sales guy and that's how he's able to build the business. But if you tell him to go become a finance guy, he's going to say, take a walk, right? Or he might say, yes, this is extremely important. Sure, I agree. I'm with you. But I'm like, but he's like, I don't know how to do this. Like, I don't care about fixing my finances. So let me go hire somebody to do it. And now if you're a small business that's at 3 million or 4 million in revenue and your EBITDA is not too high, you know, maybe $500,000, you have to really think, am I really going to go hire a CFO or a CFO organization and pay them so much money, right, to get this done? And they'll charge an arm and a leg probably to get this done. And that's where things come into play that necessarily the work doesn't get done. So there's a concept of, yes, we will have a checklist that people can go through. There is a checklist that we kind of follow internally to get these things done. But if you're not an expert, again, if you move into something like AI, if you're not an expert in automation and RPA and automation, you're really not going to be able to facilitate that change as quickly as you might like when you're about to sell your company. You know, that's kind of what you have to think about in this is really, can you do it all by yourself? The goal that we're doing is, hey, we already have all the professionals in all these aspects, right? So it's like a bunch of fractional CXs, you could say, right? So you have a fractional CFO, you have a fractional COO, you have a fractional, you could say AI expert or however you want to word that, who can come in and take care of these different aspects. And that's the value we're trying to add there. But definitely, I think a CEO can follow that checklist and try to implement each thing. But it might take away from them running the business. And that's where the struggle would be for the CEO if someone came and told me to do something different. It's very hard for me to shift into that gear when I have so much on my plate already. Am I really going to make this next thing a priority? So it's going to be tough for them unless they have a great COO or a great team set up, which is, again, a problem in small businesses. You never have enough money to hire the top tier talent that you want to reduce your time, right? So it's kind of a catch-22 there. But long answer is yes, we will have a checklist. I want to give it to people for free. You know, people can go ahead and implement it and do the best they can so they can hit all of these marks on their own and be successful.
And you'll have that up on your website, kenobicapital.com. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. We should have it in about a month or two. We haven't, you know, professionalized it yet. So working on that right now to make it something that external users can consume.
All right, perfect. And so if you're watching this in the future, today is March 3rd, 2024. So if you're watching this April, like mid-April, and you're interested in that checklist, go check the website. It might be there for you. My curiosity now goes to what is the more, it's a more personal side, especially for you. What would you say is the most rewarding part of doing this type of work?
Yeah, so going back to, I would say, my story of my dad selling the company and me being COO, that actually ended up in a lawsuit, right? We had a great valuation. We sold at a multiple we didn't think we were going to get. And it's over tens of millions of dollars, right, type of exit. And it went into a lawsuit because, you know, they would have bid high, they want to buy, whatever that case is. And what happens is, you know, you have this 60 plus year old man who has worked 20, 25 years in this business going through a heartache of now fighting a lawsuit or issuing a lawsuit and then fighting a lawsuit to get the money he's owed with all of this pressure, if you can imagine, right? And being at that age when you're like, hey, I want to retire. And that's heartache, not for him, but him, wife, kids, family, grandkids, whatever you want to look at that. And then there's external investors that have invested in this business that are all like, oh man, you made a mistake kind of thing, right? Yeah. So it's like a pretty terrible situation. And then you wait to sue because you're not, this is not your profession. You don't buy and sell companies for a living. But it's like their business model. They knew they weren't going to pay the money.
Oh, geez.
You know what I mean? That's like their whole business model in some of these companies. So how do you know who to trust when you do this? And again, you're selling a company once in your lifetime. You're not buying and selling for a living. You don't know the traps, right? You don't know what to look out for. So the reason that I'm doing this is in the future, if anybody that is of that age group or not even trying to retire, maybe they're 40s or 30s, they have a company, they want to move on to the next adventure. they should have a place to go to be like, I trust this. And it might not be the most cost-effective solution, but it's like, hey, it'll be the right thing, right? I will not get screwed. I have peace of mind. And they're going to do everything by the letter and the T because they represent me and they're here to protect me, right? And that's the mindset I go in. So the real reward is that these people that are now retiring, I guess, have nothing to worry about. They don't have to go towards a situation that we had to go through. And I mean, we would have spent over $300K in this lawsuit. We just won, like a couple weeks ago. So we just won. We're finally getting money, and all of that is happening. So it's all resolved and it ended good. But whatever that money is, you just lost $300K from that. You lost 3 years of time, which if you compound the money and you look at what that value is, there's a lot of loss. And over the loss, the heartache of going through this painful process. And I think that's a real reason I want to do this. I've been through my second sale, fixed all of those mistakes in the first sale, learned another bunch of mistakes in the second sale, which is ongoing. So we'll see how that ends up. But that's the real reason I'm doing this now and moving into this new venture, is that I want to make sure that in the future, if you want to sell your business, you want to retire, you have a financial thing, or some family member has a medical constraint, you need money and you need to get out, is there someone taking care of this for you to get you the highest possible value for your business in the proper way that is trusted, you know, is recognized, and just does a great job? So I don't have to worry about, is my business in good hands? Am I going to get money, right? And if there's a worst case scenario, we would be responsible to sue. We will take care of the heartache of fighting that because we are experts in doing that, versus the small business owner that has no idea how to do it, right?
Yeah.
So that's really the reason behind what I'm doing. And I don't see anyone else doing it in the market. There's a lot of smaller firms that might be trying to bring something in this, but this is very founder-centric and more of being partners with founders and supporting partners versus, of course, private equity's goal is to make as much money as possible for their investors, which is not really in the same incentive as aligning with the founder. Because as private equity, my job is to get the best value for the company and then sell it at the highest value, which is, this is completely different as, hey, how do I protect the founder and get them the best value in the whole, you know, business model, more than anything else.
Yeah, you're right. This type of focus is not in the conversation around this world, or at least not that I have heard. Now, admittedly, again, I'm not deep into this world. I don't know it, obviously, in an eighth of like what you do, but I do think that it's really important. And I'm very glad that we're talking so we can get this narrative out and help people understand and really feel not only your passion, but your caring for these people, and also the ability to execute and make sure that you have these airtight contracts. You know, one of the things I was reading in what you sent me was how much focus you put into the legal aspect of what you do and making sure these contracts are airtight so they don't have to spend 3 years in court to get what they're owed at the exit.
Yep. So, exactly. Yeah. And just to know all the different deal structures that certain people will throw at you. And then it's also how professional are the teams you're working with. Now, if you say, as an example, you put 10 companies in a roll up or 15 companies and you're looking at $100 million company, you could sell to a publicly traded company who has to do things professionally, right? Because they don't want to get sued. They don't want their shareholders coming back and firing the CEO of that company for doing something wrong. You know, you get to work with that class where it's more strategic and they're acquiring you for a reason, versus just to flip the business, as an example. And you can do that at those levels of scale, but you can't really do it at $5 million, mm-hmm. right? Because they can't look at you. It's not worth it. It's not worth their time. So that's one more aspect that comes into the entire thing, where you can work with those professional individuals to make it a smoother process.
Right. And with what you were saying, I want to go back a little bit about the roll up, you know, having multiple companies within one. When that kind of thing happens, is it typically that the quote unquote umbrella or parent company will keep each one in the roll up as their separate entity? Or are they doing this because they see like a future company that has all these separate aspects rolled into one?
So there's two ways to do it. And I mean, there's multiple ways private equity companies will do it in general, right? So most of them don't do them as separate entities. Most of these will say, I'm going to buy a couple of them. So I'll have the first, you know, set of buying. So maybe four companies, that'll set my base. And I'm going to go buy 10 companies under it and just integrate each company one by one by one, make it one big company, one big brand, and sell the whole thing. Right.
Okay.
And that is the traditional aspect of doing this business, because they can multiply with scale. Now, the reason, so we're doing two different models. One is we're going to keep them as individual companies. And that reason is because if the founder got a better deal somewhere else, or if they no longer want to sell, or something has changed, they have the ability to exit themselves from the role. Right? Of course, this will have some stipulations. If it's already, say, a deal is made and it's about to sell, you can't now pull out. Right? It's too late. But you can till up to that point, as an example. And you don't have to worry about your business getting affected. You can say, I want to keep it. Things are different. Whatever that scenario might change. So they have a little bit more flexibility in the way they operate. Now, what they don't get in that is they don't get the EBITDA synergy that would come of having one company, because they might still be paying for some kind of fractional HR person or finance person. And they might have extra, you know, legal costs to maintain their company and those type of expenses, which aren't, you know, taken at economics of scale. Right? Maybe you can have one HR person for 10 companies, right? Here you have one for your own company as an example. So you don't get those benefits of realizing that EBITDA at the time of sale, right? Which is really good for the guy buying you, because that CEO can come in and make all the changes and then hit his bonus and say, hey, I bought a company at 50 million and I made it worth $70 million. So it might make you more attractive to buy, because the CEO has a lot of work and his team has a lot of work to, you know, at the time of sale, put that company together and realize all of those synergies. So that's the reason. Yeah, that's the reason we keep it separately, right? Because they are buying it at a lower price. Because if you put it all together, you could probably squeeze another X amount of EBITDA, say $1 million. And then if you're selling it 8X, well, that's $8 million more. If you're selling it 12X, it's $12 million that the buyer just saved, right?
Right.
Then his team comes in, does exactly what we're talking about. They're going to increase the value of the company. And then they can be like, look at all the stuff we did. We just increased shareholder value by $20 million. Give me my bonus. Right?
Right.
We're doing a killer job. Like, you know, share prices go up or whatever that looks like for that CEO and their management team's package and how it works, or the board of directors. But they all win from this deal. There's no losing proposition unless something tanks. But even if one company tanks, the other companies are running. So you're okay. You've diversified your risk at the same time. So it's also attractive for people to buy those type of companies at that point in time, right? So there's a lot of things. So imagine that I am one company. I have X client. I have Google as my client, and they're 95% of my revenue. That company is too risky to buy, because if Google turns off your tap, I just spent X amount of dollars to buy it. Say I spent $5 million to buy it. It's worth literally $0. But if I have 10 companies, and one is Google, one is Amazon, one is Facebook, one is this small company, that small, and they have 10 clients, now I'm completely diversified. If the Google contract dies, it's like, that sucks. But I have 9 more great contracts. So it's okay. You know, it's a less risky acquisition because it's diversified. So there's advantages to both sides. And it really depends on the founder and what they want to do and which they want to join, as an example. So they have the opportunity to join either one, and it gives them flexibility, or they say, no, I want higher value, but it'll take some time and I have to lose some control. Because I might say, hey, you know, your finance person maybe is not needed, right? Might be their wife or their husband or their kids, but it's like, sorry, boss, you know, we don't need this person anymore. So you have to be okay with losing a little bit of control. So it's really up to the founder on which way they want to go.
Right. Right. Now, when you're working with these companies and these founders that maybe they're not in the best position, like the bed is messy, there's a hole in the wall, like you were talking about earlier. Now, will you go in and clean up some of that, but strategically leave some of it a little bit messy to give that other CEO the room to essentially shine his own penny and say, hey, look what I did. I increased it. Is that part of the plan here?
No, that is not part of the plan. We will come in and clean it up completely. We're going to extract as much value as possible. But when there's across 10 companies that are not combined, right? So we're doing this as individual companies.
Right.
There's still synergies if you combine it as 10 companies. Like you don't need 10 CEOs that are now in this company, right? So if you say, I'm going to let go of seven CEOs, you just save $700,000 or whatever that amount of money is. So they can still come in and do that. But from a founder and his company or her company's perspective, we will clean that up to the best possible extent because we want that company to have the maximum EBITDA possible to the group that is now exiting so that they get the maximum value in this. So we won't leave anything there. But that's if you're all individual, then the company coming in can change it up completely. They'll sign three employment contracts, say everybody else, please leave. And they're going to make it, you know, they're going to reduce their headcount significantly. And that's where they make their money.
Right. Well, thank you for clearing that distinction up. Yeah. I'm glad that it's still, you know, you're going in there to do the absolute best job you can. And it's just the roll up. And then, like you said, getting rid of all 12 CEOs or 10 or however, that's like what gets that maximum value for that transition. Yeah.
And sorry, just to add one more point, the advantage of doing that for some of these founders as well is that when you sell to, you know, a smaller deal, you know, they'll have to sign an employment agreement. It's probably going to be 2 years, but they're already checked out. As an example, they're probably not going to hit these earnouts because the targets will be ridiculous. Right. And most of these founders will not hit the earnout target. They're not going to get that money. And you'll have all of these stipulations of downside protection and, you know, competitive nature contracts and what you can do after you sell the business and talk into those relationships. But when you sell as a group, you lose a lot of those stipulations. Right now, instead of 12 people signing a 2-year employment agreement, maybe only three of them are signing a 2-year employment agreement or a 1-year employment agreement. Right. Mm-hmm. So the rest of them are free. They can move on, which is what they want to do. They don't want to sit in this company and not work for someone else for 2 years, right? After building a company for 10 years or whatever it is and being their own boss and flexibility. So they can remove a lot of these, you know, miscellaneous stipulations that are going to be there, which gives them also kind of a bigger benefit, right? So they're able to maximize value with the least, I would say under the best possible terms. And that's also a big advantage here when you do something like this.
Excellent. Yep. Great point. Thank you for adding that. And I've got to, you know, we're getting down to the wire here. So I've got to make sure that we tell people where can they find out more about you, the company, what you're up to, get in touch with you, maybe to have that initial conversation about, hey, I'm looking at exiting. Am I the right fit? Where can people go and find out more of those things?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. I mean, the first place for the most amount of information is definitely kanobicapital.com. There'll be a lot of information on the website. We are constantly changing the website. So phase two will come out soon. We're going to put a lot of free checklists and all of that so people can consume that information if they want to do something on their own and go after it. I'm on LinkedIn. You can find me at LinkedIn, you know, whatever their thing is, / Anand Kanobi Capital. That's kind of the tag at the end. So you can find me there or just search it. I mean, right now, if you put me in a Google search, I should be in the top 10 that show up already. So you should find me pretty easy there. It might still say CEO of ITT Digital. I think that hasn't changed yet. I'm trying to get that changed to be Kanobi Capital now with the exit of that company. But I'm there as well. Or you can find me on Instagram as well. So there's many ways. My email is simply anand@kanobicapital.com. So that's probably the easiest way to get in touch with me right away and, you know, always working pretty much. So you should get a response fairly quickly for something like this.
Excellent. Well, again, guys, link's going to be down below. I'll go ahead and put your email address down there too, so they can just copy and paste and get in touch with you if you think you might be a good fit for Anand's services and Kanobi Capital. So again, thank you, Anand, so much for coming on. This has been a great conversation covering a lot of bases, showing people the value that you have, and not only that, but the heart that you have for these small business owners. So thank you so much for coming on and doing what you do. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Brian. Really appreciate you having me on here. Appreciate the conversation. It's been awesome. And just looking forward to making a better future and a better world for everybody.
Amen to that, sir. All right, guys, if you like the episode, make sure you subscribe to the channel, like the episode, share it with your friends, especially if they have their own companies. They might be looking for that checklist, how to grow and move towards the exit. Do all the things, and peace. I'll see you in the next one.